There's always that competition thing going on, but then the stress level of preparing yourself for a football game so that you don't get booted off because you're not doing your job. And then also being gay, the burdens of somebody finding out your secret.
You must first express sorrow for any scandal you may have caused by your acts, public and private.
I do not.
And so it was that Roger Casement was hanged. The charge was treason, but what he was hanged for was homosexuality.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A civil unions showdown pits the ACT against Australian feds, and wisdom from the gridiron gay man who lived alone in the trenches and the human rights hero who embodied Ireland's broken heart. All that and more this week as we begin our 19th year together discovering This Way Out.
I'm Charles Hall.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian gay community for the week ending April 1st, 2006. A proposed civil unions law in the Australian Capital Territory, or ACT, has prompted the federal government's immediate vow to overturn such legislation if it passes. Introduced in the ACT Parliament this week, the bill would grant same-gender couples rights and responsibilities virtually equal to heterosexual marriage in all but name. However, just as the U.S. Congress has oversight on laws passed by the District of Columbia, Prime Minister John Howard's government can overrule any ACT law it doesn't like. Earlier this year, Attorney General Philip Ruddock said in a nationally broadcast radio interview that the question of whether or not there are civil unions is a matter for the states and territories. Ruddock angered equality activists this week by writing to ACT Chief Minister John Stanhope, who's spearheading the civil unions legislation, threatening the federal veto and warning him not to press for its passage.
The looming confrontation sparked debate on legal recognition of same-gender couples in many other parts of the country. Western Australia's gay and lesbian equality group called on its government to enact legislation similar to that introduced in the ACT, noting that the Howard government can override the laws of a territory, but not a state.
In Victoria, the Green Party asked their state parliament to follow the lead of the ACT and offer all Victorian couples legal recognition of their relationships. Independent openly gay MP Andrew Alexander has thus far been thwarted from introducing a private member's bill to create civil unions.
And in Tasmania, which enacted a form of civil unions in 2003, leading activist Rodney Croom equated ACT Chief Minister John Stanhope with popular San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom, who opened marriage to same-gender couples in his city before they were invalidated by the California Supreme Court. There will be a gap between the passage of the ACT civil union scheme and federal legislation to override it, Croom said. The former is expected to pass in May. The latter can't be passed before June. In those few short weeks, expect a large number of same-sex couples to have their union solemnized in the ACT, he continued, their ranks swollen by those who will now want to make a statement against government prejudice.
South Africa's highest court ruled late last year that the country's marriage laws discriminate against same-gender couples and ordered Parliament to enact legislation by the end of this year to eliminate that bias. Furthering couples' equality in that country, the Pretoria High Court issued a landmark ruling this week naming a gay man as the sole heir to his partner's estate. Mark Gorey has been battling the parents of his partner, Henry Brooks, over who should rightfully be the legal heir after Brooks died suddenly in April 2005 without a will. Judge Willie Hartzenberg declared the current Interstate Succession Act unconstitutional and said it should acknowledge same-gender relationships. The ruling ordered that the proceeds of the sale of the house and most of its contents that the couple co-owned, which the parents had sold in the interim, be given to Gorey. The executor and the parents were also ordered to pay all court costs. The monetary amount is reportedly not a king's ransom, but Gorey said it's never been about the money. It was about the sanctity of our relationship, he said.
But the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, the only U.S. state where same-gender marriage is legal, has upheld a law passed in 1913 that forbids out-of-state couples to wed in Massachusetts if their marriage would not be legally recognized in their home state. The antiquated legislation was passed at a time when interracial marriage was a hot-button issue, and marriage equality activists have charged Governor and probable Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney of dusting off the previously obscure law in a cynical political maneuver. Romney has said he doesn't want Massachusetts to become the Las Vegas of same-sex marriage. Rejecting a challenge to the law by 8 out-of-state couples, the court declared that the laws of this commonwealth have not endowed non-residents with an unfettered right to marry. However, the ruling applied only to the plaintiff couples from Connecticut, Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont because same-gender marriage is specifically outlawed in those states. The court withheld a ruling on the other plaintiff couples from New York and Rhode Island because neither state has a so-called defense of marriage statute or a clear-cut legal precedent that addresses the question. That part of the case was sent back to Superior Court Judge Carol Ball, who had originally upheld the 1913 law, to reconsider the measure on an expedited basis if and when same-gender marriage becomes legal in one or both of those two states.
In other U.S. state matrimonial news, Connecticut's highest court heard arguments in late March in a lawsuit brought by several lesbian-gay couples in the state challenging the ban on same-gender marriage there. It's not known when a ruling will be announced. At about the same time, lawmakers in both Maryland and New Hampshire rejected attempts to add a ban on lesbian and gay marriage to their respective state constitutions. However, Florida's Supreme Court has approved ballot language outlawing same-gender marriage or its substantial equivalent, clearing the way for a petition drive to put the issue before that state's voters in 2008.
But a young boy and his two dads will be reunited as a family thanks to a Maryland trial court ruling this week. Ulf Hedberg and Blaise Delahousse have been forced to live apart since mid-2002 after a Virginia court ruled that Hedberg could not maintain custody of his son unless his partner moved out of the home they'd shared for years. The family moved to Maryland, where the men maintained separate residences, and in 2004, Hedberg asked the state to modify the custody order. The trial court initially granted summary judgment to the boy's mother, Hedberg's ex-wife, who had moved to Florida and who objected to Delahousse's second dad status, arguing that a Maryland court didn't have the right to revisit custody orders from a different state. But in June 2005, a Maryland appeals court sent the matter back to trial. Since none of the parties remained in Virginia, and because Maryland had become the boy's home state, the court now ruled Maryland has jurisdiction, and the custody terms could be modified if a material change in circumstances arose that was not in the best interest of the child. The court agreed with Hedberg's assertion that his now 13-year-old son was very unhappy over being separated from Delahousse, and that the teen's quality of life had been substantially diminished because he missed living with his two dads under one roof. Hedberg's lawyer, Susan Silber, called the decision an important ruling which acknowledges the best interest of the child. We are pleased to reunite this loving family.
Also reunited with his loving family this week was Canadian James Loney following 4 months of captivity as a hostage in Iraq. What wasn't known until now is that the Christian peace activist is a gay man. His family and his partner, Dan Hunt, kept quiet about Loney's sexual orientation out of fear for what his captors might do if they found out. As reports out of Iraq continue to describe more and more religious-inspired killings of gay men, being out can literally be life-threatening in that country. Loney was rescued by coalition forces last week, along with fellow Canadian Harmeet Souden and Briton Norman Kember. The executed body of a fourth hostage, American Tom Fox, was found earlier this month in Baghdad. Reading from a brief prepared statement, Loney told reporters, "I need some time to get reacquainted with my partner Dan, my family, community, and freedom itself. I'm eager to tell the story of my captivity and rescue," he said, "but I need a little time first."
And finally, if we awarded a prize for a homophobe of the week, there would be at least a few candidates this week. The City Council of Kanab, Utah, has formally proclaimed support for the natural family, defined as a working husband, a stay-at-home wife, and what the council referred to as a full quiver of children. But local businesses this week, seeing the tourist dollar downside, began distancing themselves from that proclamation. Signs have popped up in shop windows in Kanab featuring a string of rainbow-colored people with the slogan, "Everyone welcome here."
Speaking just days before Italy's national elections, Pope Benedict XVI this week denounced same-gender marriage, saying that the Church has a duty to defend the recognition and promotion of the natural structure of the family as a union between a man and a woman based on marriage. But that's a variation of the same old song Benedict has been crooning on a regular basis since even before he became Pope.
Another old song asks,
"How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that doggy's for sale."
And the blatantly biased prize this week, if we awarded one, would go to a kennel owner in Sweden for her homophobic response to that musical question. Sweden's Discrimination Ombudsman, a government watchdog agency, filed a lawsuit charging that the unidentified pet proprietor was eager to sell a puppy to a female customer, but then refused after she discovered that the woman lives with a lesbian partner. The court fined the hateful kennel owner 20,000 kroner, about $2,600, for, one could say, barking up the wrong tree.
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 1st, 2006, written this week by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Charles Hall.
We'll begin the story of a relatively unknown Irish human rights hero who was ultimately hanged for his homosexuality later in the program. The gasps of surprise could be heard all over the sports world when pro football player Asara Tuaolo added his name to the very short list of professional male athletes who have publicly come out. Tuaolo is telling his own story in the recently released Alone in the Trenches, My Life as a Gay Man in the NFL. He chatted with This Way Out correspondent Abigail Garner about the pressures of secrecy and the relief of coming out.
By coming out, you shattered a lot of stereotypes about what straight people think of when they think of gay people. But I also think that being a football player, you also shattered stereotypes within the LGBT community. What have been some of the common reactions that LGBT people have had?
You know, it's been incredible. Through my website, I've gotten a lot of emails from fans and support from a lot of our organizations. And it's just a surprise thing. You know, since football is such a homophobic, macho, rough and tough, you know, somebody, you know, people's perspective of a gay person would be like Jack on Will and Grace. But breaking down those walls of stereotypes, it was just incredible to see the feedback that I got from a lot of our GLBT community.
I was struck by how stressful, both physically and emotionally, it is for players in the NFL to stay in the game. Because casual sports fans may look at a player and presume that he's got it made. But constantly there's a struggle going on.
Definitely.
Like survival of the fittest, to avoid injury, not getting bumped off the team.
Well, always, you know, realizing that there's somebody behind you waiting to get your job. But yeah, there's always that competition thing going on. But then the stress level of performing every single week and preparing yourself for a football game so that you don't get booted off and because you're not doing your job. There's a lot of stress involved. And then also being gay kind of just adds another, you know, thing to it, another obstacle. I always tell a lot of when I go and speak that, you know, making the NFL or getting to the NFL is a difficult task, you know, starting from high school to college and then being able to get drafted. But it's harder if you're a gay man because there's so many other stuff that you carry along, the burdens of somebody finding out your secret. And of course, you and I know in today's society, being gay is not a popular thing, and especially being gay in the athletic world.
Talk about the stress of being in the closet. How difficult was that for you while you were playing in the NFL? And what sorts of things did you do to stay in the closet?
You know, many sleepless nights. It got difficult when I got drafted into the NFL because it became corporate. It became a job then. It wasn't like, you know, playing for the love of the game from high school to college. Once I, you know, got into the NFL, it was the limelight, the glamour of the whole thing, and knowing that someone, you know, could come and out you, and you could lose everything that you worked so hard for, everything, every sacrifice I made to get where I was at, by just somebody starting a rumor about me being gay or outing me.
Even on your best days, you were worried about being too good for fear that any attention that you might get for your success on the field,
yes,
that it would shine a spotlight on your personal life.
Almost,
and people would discover it.
Yes. You know, it was always like somebody watching that I've been with before, and as a gay man, watching a television show and seeing like, oh my, or a game and seeing like, oh my gosh, I know that guy, you know? Because there's a lot of times I didn't, in the book, there's a lot of times I didn't tell people my real name. I was always, I had an alias. So it was just so difficult. So for somebody to try to recognize me and, you know, the next day, wake up, you know, and see like the headlines, you know, Ezra Tua Olo Gay or something like that. It was just really hard for me.
To stay in the closet, then, you had to suppress your talent. Do you ever wonder how you would have played differently if you didn't have to worry about that?
You know what? I do now. Yeah, it's so funny. Now that I'm out and living in my truth and stuff, and I look back into my life from starting from high school and college, I was a great player. You know, I won a lot of awards in high school. I was the best defensive player of the league. I mean, in college, I won the Morris Trophy, which is the best defensive line in the Pac-10. You know, so I look back, and it's difficult to look back now because you never know, you know, what could have been. But, you know, I wouldn't change it for the world. I mean, you know, of course, you know, being in the closet and stuff hindered a lot of things for me. But, you know, maybe I wouldn't be in the position I am in now to, you know, to help people, to inspire, you know, a lot of our younger generation.
You say that your gaydar while you're in the NFL was not well-tuned, and so you really can't tell or can't speak to whether or not there are other players that you met or worked with.
Yeah.
Now, do you kind of wonder sometimes when you see, I don't know, I'm not asking you to name names, little times where it may seem as if they're sabotaging their own work?
You know, yeah, my gaydar was kind of a little cloudy because I think fear had a lot to do with that. You know, me living in fear all my life, you know, in football. So it was a little cloudy. But now that I look back and I think back and stuff, you know, there are players and stuff that you thought maybe, well, you know, he could be, but, I don't know for sure. You know, he's wearing a mascara mask, so I'm not sure. No, I'm just kidding.
For example.
No. But, you know, it's just, you know, I do look back and I think, oh, I wonder if he was, you know. But then again, I also think, well, if he was, he probably would have contacted me, you know, when I came out. So it's, you know, it's, if I also understand their pain and I understand what they're going through, you know, because it's really not accepted in the sports realm or sports arena, especially with, you know, the good old boy sports of NFL football.
Do you still watch football?
I do. And I got to say, I enjoy it a lot more than I did ever, you know?
Do you anticipate a time when gay NFL players will be able to be out and fully participate in the sport?
I pray and I hope. Seriously, I do. And, you know, because I understand what they're going through. And to be able to be yourself, anyone that knows that, just to be able to be free and of no type of drama or trauma or anything like that, it's incredible. And man, I do pray and hope that someday a gay NFL player will come out while he's still playing, because I think it'd be a huge step for us.
The book is Alone in the Trenches, My Life as a Gay Man in the NFL. The author is Asera Tuaolo. For This Way Out in Minneapolis, I'm Abigail Garner.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine brought to you by you. Your charitable donations keep this program on the air. We've produced some special CDs to say thank you to our supporters, featuring queer history, reviews of LGBT music, and behind-the-scenes looks at relevant movies and TV shows. You can also now get CDs of our regular program by subscription, and be sure you never miss a week of This Way Out. For all the details, please visit our website at thiswayout.org. You can also demonstrate your solidarity by taking part in an online benefit auction. Look for the This Way Out area at alternabid.com. Again, to find out more about special CD thank you gifts, subscriptions, and the auction, please do log on to thiswayout.org, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA.
Humanitarian and infamous Irish patriot Sir Roger Casement was such a controversial figure in his country's history that arguments about his sexual orientation raged for almost 90 years after his death in 1916. But we don't want to get ahead of the story. Casement's fascinating life has been dramatized by writer-producer Hugh Young in The Broken Heart of Ireland, a four-part biography narrated by Barry Empson. Here's part one.
Was on Good Friday morning, all in the month of May, a German ship was signaling beyond Altinda Bay.
It's the chaplain again, Casement.
Good day, my son. I've been to the Archbishop, and he says you must first express sorrow for any scandal you may have caused by your acts, public and private.
I do not.
Then you know that in that case, my son, you cannot be received into the Holy Church, and tomorrow you will die in mortal sin.
Cardinal Bourne is trying to make me betray my soul.
May the Lord have mercy upon you.
Amen.
And so it was that Roger Casement was faithful to us, to those he called our kind, right to the end. For on August the 3rd, 1916, he was hanged. The charge was treason, but what he was hanged for was homosexuality. Roger David Casement was born in Dublin on September the 1st, 1864. His parents were both Catholic, but when he was still small, both his parents died, and he was sent north to his mother's relatives, Ulster Protestants of Scottish stock, in County Antrim. So Roger was raised a Presbyterian and an Ulsterman. From his childhood, he delighted almost everyone who met him. His favourite cousin Gertrude said,
"In appearance, Roddy was strikingly handsome. He was over 6 feet when he was 17. His eyes were grey and deep-set, his face rather thin, and his hair nearly black and curly. He had good teeth and a very clear skin."
Fond of painting and inventing stories and writing poetry, he had a beautiful baritone speaking and singing voice, and he was particularly interested in Irish history. His uncle got him a job as a shipping clerk in Liverpool, but he begged a job as a purser on one of their ships to Boma, near the mouth of the Congo, and this led to a lifelong association with Africa. In 1884, he went on an expedition into the African Congo with the Congo International Association. On that expedition, the Congolese called Casement Swami, meaning women's god, and Monafuma, son of a king. Fred Bulliston, an adventurer on the expedition, said,
"He deserved both names, for a more charming, lovable man never lived."
In 1890, Casement met Captain Joseph Korzeniowski, better known as the author Joseph Conrad, and he remembered,
"He is a limpid personality, most intelligent and sympathetic. There is a touch of the conquistador in him, too. I have seen him start off into an unspeakable wilderness, swinging a crook-handled stick for all weapons, and a Luanda boy carrying a bundle for all company. A few months afterwards, I saw him come out again, a little leaner, a little browner, with his stick, dogs, and Luanda boy, and quietly serene as though he had been for a stroll in the park."
The boy was probably a young adult, and may well have contributed to his serenity. The villain of this part of the story is King Leopold. By a lot of clever dealing, he secured the so-called Congo Free State, now Zaire, as his personal property, and the wealth of the Congo Free State was rubber. This was the beginning of the age of the inflatable tire and countless other uses for the sap of the rubber tree. Leopold had expelled the slave traders, but instead he allowed his agents to force the Congolese to provide a weekly quota of rubber. If they failed, they were shot down and their hands or feet were cut off and taken as trophies. And Leopold himself was embezzling the profits from the rubber trade. Casement was made British consul in Angola in 1895 and continued to collect information and forward it to the Foreign Office. In 1903, he led a secret mission into the Congo Free State. Meanwhile, he was going on other secret missions. His diary for February the 18th, 1903, reports,
"So enormous, beautiful."
And on his way back to the Congo, he stopped at Madeira, where he met youths like Agostino.
"Kissed many times. Splendid."
"Juan."
18 passatas, 20 years.
"And Pepe."
17. Bought cigarettes, much bueno. 16 passatas.
The first few pages of this diary are missing. We shall learn why toward the end of his life story. Casement's report on the Congo was mucked around with endlessly by the Foreign Office, and Leopold put out countervailing propaganda. But British public opinion swung in behind Casement, and Punch ran a squib.
"The Congo state is a thriving speculation for the happy Belgian nation. The receipts are great and are yearly getting bigger. But I'm glad I'm not an owner in the Congo state."
The British finally sent a commission, and in 1905, a chief showed them how many people had been killed by laying twigs on their table.
"These are for chiefs. These are men. These smaller are for women. And these smallest, these are children."
A total of 110 twigs. And one by one, natives had appeared to show their mutilated arms until the commissioners could stand it no longer. It wasn't plain sailing from then on. The Foreign Office was more concerned with its Belgian relations. But Leopold had to make some reforms. And when he died in 1909, his son made more. For his work, Casement was awarded the CMG. And next time, we'll tell you about Casement in the Amazon.
But no answering signal did come from their lonely banner strand.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Charles Hall, Rex Wachner, Graham Underhill, Abigail Garner, and Hugh Young contributed program material. Thanks also to Ann McNally. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out exclusively on planetout.com. There's also a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to find out how you can help keep this program on the air and choose from some unique This Way Out queer history, music, and culture CDs that you can own as our thanks. That's thiswayout.org. To sign up for our weekly emailed program information messages and or our monthly This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on WHRW Binghamton, New York, KHEN Salida, Colorado, 5GFM Kadena, South Australia, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. We're all going to stay tuned.